And then right when we got rounded the corner to the tennis courts, a man stood up in the bushes right where that gateway is, where the other side of the tennis courts is.
Federal Way High School is located in Federal Way, Washington, just west of the busy Pacific Highway South. The school boasts a diverse student body, reflecting the multicultural fabric of the surrounding area. The students at the school were excited for Christmas approaching on the 14th of December, 1991. It was just a couple of weeks away before they got off for winter break, but there was still a flurry of activity at the school. That particular morning, the school's drill team had a practice session scheduled ahead of their upcoming performance at a nearby school. Comprising students who showcased dance routines at various school events and competitions, the drill team held an important place in the school community. Despite it being a Saturday morning, students trickled in, but as they arrived, they noticed that a car was already parked in the lot. The vehicle belonged to 16-year-old Sarah Yarborough, a member of the drill team. However, Sarah wasn't in her car. It appeared as though she had arrived early to set up for practice. Meanwhile, as other students convened for practice, a local man jogged along a path cutting between the high school stadium and outdoor tennis court. As he jogged past a brushy area just off the path, he spotted a man leaning over what appeared to be a semi-naked woman on the ground. He noticed that her shirt was off and her breasts were exposed. The jogger was embarrassed, assuming he had inadvertently intruded upon a private moment. He quickly hurried past, but a nagging curiosity prompted him to glance back for a second look. He then resumed on his route, unaware that he was about to be thrust into the middle of a murder investigation. Sarah Yarborough was born to parents Tom and Lori on the 12th of June, 1975, in Portland, Oregon. She was affectionately dubbed her mother's mini-me, due to her striking red hair and similar tone and voice. The couple went on to have two more children, Andy and Micah, and Sarah loved being the big sister. Whenever her little brother Andy asked what a bad word meant, she always explained it to him. At the age of eight, the family uprooted their lives and relocated to Federal Way, Washington, where both Tom and Lori found employment with Weyerhaeuser Co. Tom served as an electrical engineer, while Lori pursued her career as a nurse. Sarah seamlessly assimilated into life at Federal Way High School, effortlessly forging friendships. The Arbor family actively participated in the activities of the Bible Baptist Church in Auburn, where Sarah energetically engaged in the youth group. Jean Pepino, the church's youth pastor, fondly reminisced. She was one of those model kids. She really had everything going for her. By 1991, Sarah, at 16 years old, stood at the threshold of adulthood. She possessed a passion for ballet and consistently excelled academically. Her friend, Christy Carson, fondly recalled, "I don't think she ever did a mean thing to anyone in the entire world. She was always there for you when you were down." Sarah and Christy forged their friendship when Sarah's family relocated to Federal Way, and their bond endured through the years. They attended the same school, and they were both active members of Campfire, as well as its affiliated group, the Safety Kids. This group gave dance performances worldwide, delivering an anti-drug and anti-alcohol message. Sarah's dedication to the cause led her to accompany the group on trips to places such as New Zealand. Recently, they'd been working on a new routine prompting teen abstinence, and Sarah was one of their top dancers. Her exceptional dancing skills positioned her as a contender for Campfire's highest youth honour, the Wahello Award. Mary Olson, Campfire's director, praised Sarah, noting, "She was one of those people who would have made a difference in the world, who cared about people and took action." Despite her proficiency in ballet, Sarah sought new challenges. Joining the school's drill team was just the beginning. She harboured aspirations beyond the realm of dance. She wanted to become a museum curator, and her dreams extended as far as envisioning herself working in France one day. Alternatively, she contemplated following in her grandfather's footsteps. He had been an engineer at Weyerhaeuser Co., where their shared passion for tinkering led to their creation of Rocky the Robot. This real-life mechanical marvel, which stood at the size of a small filing cabinet, emerged from an intricate kit designed for skilled enthusiasts like Sarah and her grandfather John. On Friday the 13th of December 1991, Sarah found herself home alone for the weekend as Tom and Laurie were away at their son's soccer game at Ocean Shores in Grays Harbour County. Despite their initial apprehension, Sarah reassured them of her safety. She had arranged for her friend Kirsty Carson to stay over, and she had access to her grandfather's car. Upon Kirsty's arrival, they made a trip to the nearby grocery store to stock up on snacks. Later that evening, they attended a local basketball game at the school, where Sarah felt a nervous excitement about the upcoming Morp dance, a reverse prom where the girl asks the guy. She had hoped to ask a boy that she liked, but he wasn't at the basketball game that night, leaving her disappointed. Following the game, Sarah and Kirsty grabbed some fast food before returning home to enjoy movies and snacks. They rented some movies and fell asleep in the living room in front of the television. The next morning, Sarah woke in a panic, thinking that she was late for drill team practice. They were supposed to meet at the school that morning to practice before getting the bus to another school for their competition. Sarah hurriedly donned her uniform, still adorned with hot rollers in her hair, and rushed out to drive Kirsty home before heading on to the school. However, her sense of urgency was misplaced. She had mistaken the time and arrived at school an hour earlier than necessary. In the quiet of the empty parking lot, Sarah switched off the engine and realized her mistake in the early morning haze. As students began arriving at the school that morning, they noticed Sarah's car parked in the lot, but no sign of Sarah herself. Assuming she had already gone inside to prepare for practice, they didn't give it much thought. Then at around 9:15 a.m, a jogger stumbled upon what appeared to be a young couple engaged in intimate activity in the bushes near the school. The spot was nestled about a third of the way down a slope, surrounded by parking lots and shielded by tall evergreens, providing seclusion from prying eyes. The jogger felt embarrassed by the encounter and quickly moved on, thinking nothing more of it. Moments later, two teenage boys, Andrew Miller and his friend Adam, were strolling along the same path, nearing the bushes where the jogger had spotted the young couple. Andrew and his friend were taking a shortcut through the area with their skateboards. As they approached the bushes, a man suddenly emerged, startling them both. Andrew later recalled,
"And then right when we got rounded the corner to the tennis courts, a man stood up in the bushes right where that gateway is, where the other side of the tennis courts is. And then, you know, we just stopped because he's standing up in the middle of the bushes at that time of the morning. What's he doing there? It's pretty creepy."
The man quickly walked away, leaving the boys unsettled. As they cautiously approached the spot where the man had been standing, Something on the ground caught their eye.
Really hard to say. A girl that was most likely dead, with her eyes open, her mouth open, and looked like she was fought really hard.
It was Sarah. She lay motionless, partially unclothed, with a nylon stocking tightly wrapped around her neck. Her clothes were neatly piled beside her. Frozen with fear, the boys barely had a moment to process the scene before them. Before the man turned around and glared at them.
He looked like he had either scars or acne on his face, or dirt. He was staring back at us because he knew we now saw what he did.
Without hesitation, they bolted in the opposite direction, sprinting to Andrew's house, where his father immediately called 911. Following the discovery of the body outside in the bushes, it was swiftly identified as Sarah. Concerned friends had noticed her car in the parking lot, but they couldn't find her, prompting them to contact her parents, who then alerted police. Sarah's uniform, which bared her name, aided in her identification. Tom and Lori immediately raced home.
When we got there, that was when they told us that her body had been found.
Forensic experts promptly arrived at the scene to commence their investigation. They meticulously documented the body and the surroundings before Sarah was transported to the medical examiner's office. Upon examination, the pathologist determined that Sarah had been sexually assaulted and then strangled to death with her own nylon stockings. Although there was no evidence of rape, semen was discovered on Sarah's clothing, indicating a sexual assault. Contusions to her jaw and eye suggested a possible initial physical confrontation, and the pathologist suggested that she had been punched from behind. Scrapes on her knees and calves indicated that she may have been dragged into the bushes. The pathologist concluded that Sarah had fought fiercely for her life during the attack, and it was estimated that she had been killed around an hour before her body was discovered. The murder investigation kicked into gear, with detectives initiating interviews with everybody close to Sarah. The suspicion loomed that Sarah's murder was targeted, as if somebody had been lying in wait for her arrival at school that morning. Yet interviews showed that Sarah appeared to be a well-rounded and well-liked teenager with no known enemies. The scope of the investigation widened, prompting detectives to conduct door-to-door inquiries in the vicinity of the school. Their aim was to determine whether any residents had witnessed or heard anything unusual that morning. Meanwhile, as the investigation pressed on, students returned to school, where they were met by a team of trained crisis counsellors. Superintendent Richard Harris remarked, "They'll help us get back to normalcy. If there's such a thing as normalcy after an episode like this." The school also upped their security measures, addressing students' fears of the killer. Some even harbored suspicions that the killer might be another student. The grief hung heavy in the air, as one teacher, Merlin Epp, recalled. "I had never experienced the kind of shock, the kind of glazed experience that kids had in their countenances. In the halls, it was hushed. It was more than a pall that fell over the student body. It was as if the school had turned into a morgue." Sarah's empty desk in the classroom became something of a holy ground. Teachers decided it was best to keep it empty, kind of as a memorial to Sarah, although she would never be returning to school. Hair thinning affects approximately half of all women, but there's no need to face it alone. Join the ranks of over a million individuals who have taken charge of their hair health with Nutrafol, the top choice among dermatologists for hair growth supplements. With a vast number of users reporting thicker, stronger, and faster growing hair with reduced shedding, Nutrafol is the ultimate solution. Understanding that every individual's hair needs are unique, Nutrafol offers a range of formulas tailored to address specific concerns. Personally, I've incorporated their vegan supplements into my routine, and the results speak for themselves. My hair has never been healthier. Establishing a hair growth regimen with Nutrafol couldn't be easier. Simply purchase online without needing a prescription and take the first step towards achieving visibly thicker hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering Morbidology listeners $10 off their first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code Morbidology. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code Morbidology. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code Morbidology. Before we continue with today's episode, I want to introduce you to a captivating true crime podcast I've been immersing myself in lately. It's called True Crime Couple, hosted by Kay and John. In each episode, Kay narrates various true crime cases to John, and together with us listeners, John navigates through all the intricate details and twists. True Crime Couple prioritizes the victims and releases episodes bi-weekly, covering a diverse array of cases, particularly focusing on lesser-known ones. From the tragic story of Daniel Halseth, killed by his daughter and her boyfriend, who then shamelessly shared a video of them practically making a confession on social media, to the unsettling case of the Kirkland cult, the podcast explores cases from all walks of life. You can tune in to True Crime Couple on all podcast platforms, and I guarantee you'll be just as engrossed as I am. During interviews with locals, detectives gleaned information about the man sighted in the bushes where Sarah's body was discovered. Both the jogger and the two young boys described a white male in his 20s, approximately 6 feet tall and of medium build. He sported shoulder-length blonde hair, wore a dark trench coat and pants. The two boys were sure that they saw him drive off in a 1970s Chevrolet Nova, either brown or tan in colour. Detectives issued a public appeal, urging the man to come forward for questioning. Upon the release of the description and composite sketch of the suspect, King County Police Captain Michael Nault urgently reached out to the Washington State Crime Lab. In a letter, he implored them to prioritise Sarah's murder, ensuring that any evidence sent to them would be fast-tracked for analysis. With a substantial amount of evidence amassed in the case, detectives hoped it would provide crucial leads in identifying Sarah's killer. Meanwhile, the shock of the murder reverberated throughout the community, instilling fear in parents and children alike. If Sarah's murder was indeed a random act, the perpetrator was still at large, and he may have been thinking about targeting another victim. In a concerted effort to apprehend the killer, over 20 detectives were assigned to the case, a significantly larger team than typically allocated for murder investigations in the area. Some detectives were reassigned from other cases to lend their expertise. As Captain Nault affirmed, "It's very rare to give a case this kind of priority. We're not going to let up." Detectives were convinced that the individual seen in the bushes was the killer. Yet, frustratingly, no one could positively identify him based on the sketch and description. Detectives dismissed the notion that Sarah knew her killer, or that he was another student. Instead, they theorized that the man with shoulder-length blonde hair had seen Sarah in the parking lot and seized his opportunity to sexually assault and kill her. Driven by a desire for justice, the community and Sarah's loved ones were determined to see her killer arrested. On the 18th of that month, a $10,000 reward was offered, courtesy of the Weyerhaeuser Co., where Sarah's parents and grandfather were employed. Mike Walters, the company spokesperson, emphasized their familial connection to Sarah, stating, "Her mother, father, and grandfather are all employees and have been for years." Meanwhile, as the investigation continued, detectives released a psychological profile of Sarah's killer. They believed that he might be a sexual psychopath, somebody driven by bizarre fantasies and struggling to control his impulses.
If you know the man who killed at Federal Way High School, then police say you will have recognized the odd changes in his behavior. If so, they need to hear from you.
Although the FBI had yet to conduct a comprehensive profile, awaiting more evidence, the local community took matters into their own hands. Leaflets featuring a composite sketch of the suspect and a description of his vehicle were distributed throughout the area. Detectives also pursued another avenue, appealing to the public for any videotapes or photographs from the basketball game Sarah and her friend had attended the night before. They considered that the perpetrator could have been someone familiar with the school, possibly attending its events. Detectives also speculated that the killer was an opportunistic individual, lurking until an opportunity presented itself to strike when a girl was vulnerable and alone. Tragically, that girl happened to be Sarah. Despite the onset of the new year yielding no fresh leads, it did yield a more intricate psychological profile of Sarah's killer. Bob Gibo, an FBI-trained detective specializing in offender analysis, shared his insights. He characterized the killer as highly disorganized, likely to linger outside public restrooms or malls, leering at women. Gibo also surmised that the killer likely collected pornography and had poor personal hygiene habits, infrequently laundering his clothes or bathing. Furthermore, Gibo speculated that the killer may have sustained injuries during the attack, necessitating an explanation for any wounds. It was also suggested that the killer disposed of his car afterwards. He might have fled town, possibly fabricating a visit to a distant relative, a behavior inconsistent with his typical routine. Gibo's analysis hinted at the killer's sexual dysfunction and difficulty forming normal relationships, possibly stemming from childhood abuse or a criminal record involving charges such as indecent exposure. In unveiling the profile, Gibo remarked, "He had no place to go. The best he could do for privacy was a brushy field with a running path where people were likely to come by, and they did. A witness saw the killer in the brush where Yarborough's body was found. When he was spotted, he panicked. He didn't know what to do." Gibo believed that the killer's clumsy actions indicated that Sarah was most likely his first victim. Armed with this refined profile, detectives urged the public to come forward with any information regarding individuals fitting the criteria. Despite the detailed composite sketch, description, and psychological profile, the killer still remained unidentified. With each passing day of the unsolved case, the community's anxiety intensified. Some high school students resorted to carrying weapons for self-protection, and individuals avoided being alone at all costs. Roy O'Malley, a junior at the high school, vocalized his concerns to the media, stating, "The killer is crazy enough to do it in the morning. What's going to stop him from doing it to a guy?" Then on the 12th of January, a disturbing incident occurred at Olympic Sports involving two women. A man in his mid-20s, with a slender build, brown collar-length hair and bangs obscuring his eyes, approached them and requested to use the restroom. One of the women escorted him upstairs to the employee restroom, before returning to her duties on the main floor. Shortly after, another employee entered the woman's restroom and was horrified to find the man exposing himself. He attempted to grab her, but she managed to flee. Upon informing her colleague, they discovered the man still in the restroom in the same position. After reporting the incident to their manager, the man left the store as if nothing had happened. The man had resembled the composite sketch of Sarah's killer, prompting the women to call police. Detectives considered the possibility of a connection, but they struggled to locate the suspect. Shortly thereafter, detectives discovered a vehicle that matched the vehicle the suspect had allegedly driven. However, instead of propel the case, it only caused further complications. The man who owned the vehicle admitted to being close to the high school that day, but he said he had just stopped for a coffee and a donut. While it seemed like a great lead at first, the man was quickly ruled out as a suspect. The forensic evidence had now been returned from the lab, and when the DNA found at the scene was compared to this man's DNA, it wasn't a match. This new development fueled speculation that the man spotted at the school and in the bushes might indeed be Sarah's killer, but the owner of the car was innocent. The killer could have been driving another car that was unseen by witnesses, but he also could have been on foot. Despite months of exhausted efforts, detectives remained no closer to solving Sarah's murder. In March, an anonymous donation increased the reward fund to nearly $17,000. While the sizable incentive encouraged cooperation, the community's collective efforts yielded no breakthroughs. Not a single person could identify the man in the composite sketch. And by June, it had been 6 months since Sarah was killed. As the months dragged on, the case was only getting colder and colder, and an opportunistic killer still lurked in the midst. As the anniversary of Sarah's murder loomed, her family found themselves grappling with a year of unbearable pain. Lori, Sarah's mother, reflected, "The shock has worn off. Now there's just pain." Despite the case maintaining top priority status, the influx of tips had dwindled to a discouraging silence. More than 3,000 leads had poured in from across the region, each meticulously investigated, yet none held any significant breakthroughs. With the detective staff scaled back to one remaining investigator, Jim Donyon, a seasoned veteran with experience in high-profile cases such as the Green River killings, hopes remained anchored to his expertise in cracking cold cases. Detective Donyon, who was renowned for his investigative prowess, lamented, "That girl did not deserve to be killed in that way. No one does. But this was a particularly promising citizen who would have made a real difference to the community had she been allowed to live." In a bid to reignite the investigation, Detective Donyon unveiled his strategy to the public. He proposed revisiting the names provided by previous callers and requesting DNA samples from these individuals. However, DNA testing was still in its relatively early stages and lacked the sophistication of today's CODIS system, a national DNA database housing profiles of convicts and their DNA. This meant that the comparison process relied solely on voluntary DNA submissions. Despite Detective Donyon's thorough efforts to revisit persons of interest and obtain DNA samples, each potential lead ultimately led to a dead end. Expressing his frustration, the detective remarked, "Something that looks good on paper tends to fall apart." However, he remained resolute in his determination not to abandon the case. Asserting his belief in its solvability, he stated, "I personally think this case is definitely solvable." He based this conviction not only on the forensic evidence gathered, but also on the numerous eyewitnesses who had encountered the killer that morning. In May, a renewed effort saw the creation and distribution of a fresh composite sketch of the killer that had been crafted with input from eyewitnesses. Detectives had shown these witnesses photographs of men resembling the suspect, prompting them to identify specific features that matched the killer. Upon viewing the new sketch, the two teenage boys who had the clearest glimpse of the killer confirmed that it was accurate. Despite generating a few new leads, none of them provided the breakthrough necessary to identify Sarah's killer, leaving detectives grappling with the frustrating reality of an unsolved case. In the same year, Sarah's classmates marked what would have been her 18th birthday with their graduation ceremony. They honored her memory by dedicating a memorial at the school, a bronze bench adorned with symbols representing her passions, a satchel, a stack of books, ballet slippers, a necktie, and the Latin phrase, carpe diem. Perched atop the bench was a small dog figurine, reminiscent of Sarah's beloved pet, who outlived her by 7 years, seemingly waiting patiently for her return. Adjacent to the bench, a plaque bore a poignant inscription. To honour Sarah Yarborough, seeker of knowledge, truth and holiness, seer of truth, beauty and dreams. By 1995, Detective Donyon's hope was fading. Reflecting on the case, he acknowledged, "Nobody wants to hear this, but sometimes people do get away with murder. And there's a chance whoever murdered Sarah might be an example of that." Little did he know it would be over another decade before a breakthrough would finally occur. Tragically, however, before justice could be served, Detective Donyon passed away. He succumbed to Lou Gehrig's disease in 2004 at the age of 59. Before that, he had dedicated himself to the task force, refusing to retire without witnessing the resolution of the Green River killings and the conviction of Gary Ridgway. Just a week before his death, Detective Donyon confessed that his greatest regret in life was being unable to find Sarah's killer. But unbeknownst to him at the time, advancements in DNA technology were on the horizon, inching closer to unveiling the truth behind Sarah's murder. By 2009, the CODIS system had become operational. Despite running the killer's DNA through it, no matches were found. This indicated that the killer had not been arrested for another crime, but if apprehended in the future, their DNA would flag as a match. Towards the year's end, the announcement came that the murder investigation had been reignited. Leading the charge was Detective Tom Jensen, who was tasked with sifting through the extensive array of tips accumulated over the years. He expressed, "If somebody just wants to drop a name on us, that's all we need. We have all the evidence we need to convict somebody of this crime." Progress remained stagnant until 2011, when detectives sought assistance from Colleen Fitzpatrick of Identifinders International in Huntington Beach, California, to explore forensic genetic genealogy. With a background in nuclear physics, Fitzpatrick had transitioned into leveraging forensic genealogy to track individuals or their relatives. This innovative investigative tool combines DNA analysis with genealogical research, comparing DNA samples with genetic databases to identify individuals or their relatives. The killer's DNA was forwarded to Fitzpatrick, and by January of 2012, the analysis unveiled a surprising revelation. The killer was distantly related to three passengers who arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts on the Mayflower in 1620. Fitzpatrick suggested that there was a likelihood the killer shared the surname of those distant relatives, Fuller. Specifically, the killer was traced back to Robert Fuller, a descendant of Salem in 1630. Although he himself wasn't on the Mayflower, his relatives were. Fitzpatrick clarified, "We don't dig up 400-year-old people or anything like that. I don't know who gave the DNA, but these people have worked out their family trees pretty well. DNA has become a very big deal for genealogists in the last 10 years. Initially, detectives combed through their list of persons of interest, but they found no matches with the name Fuller. Eventually, they opted to make their findings public, hoping someone would connect the dots and name Sarah's killer. Now, they could only wait for a breakthrough from the public. Detectives had held on to hope that the case would be solved that year. But as time passed, months turned into years without progress. In February of 2018, they decided to employ a new strategy in their pursuit of Sarah's killer. Utilizing innovative technology, they released a new rendering of the suspect, crafted by Parabon Nano Labs. This is a Virginia-based DNA technology company known for predicting physical appearances from DNA evidence. The rendering depicted a man of Northern European descent with either green or blue eyes. Despite the effort, the identity of the suspect remained elusive, but the detectives remained steadfast in their determination. Their breakthrough finally arrived the following year, in late September. Fitzpatrick's team made a significant discovery upon finding two descendants of Robert Fuller, brothers Edward and Patrick Nicholas. Upon further investigation, it was revealed that Edward's DNA profile was already in the CODIS database, but it didn't match the killer's DNA. This left detectives with only one viable suspect, 55-year-old Patrick Leon Nicholas. With Nicholas identified as their primary suspect, detectives began surveillance. One afternoon, they observed him smoking a cigarette outside a strip mall in Kent. Upon his departure, detectives swiftly retrieved the discarded cigarette butts and a napkin he had used, seizing potential crucial evidence. This collected evidence was promptly sent to the State Crime Lab for analysis. The results confirmed what detectives had suspected. The DNA found at the crime scene was a perfect match to Patrick Nicholas. With this conclusive evidence in hand, they wasted no time in arresting Nicholas. He was apprehended at a local bar on the 2nd of October and was charged with first-degree murder. For Sarah's family, this moment marked the culmination of nearly 3 decades of waiting and hoping for justice. Lori, Sarah's mother, expressed her astonishment and gratitude, stating, "I was really surprised. I wondered perhaps if the person was no longer living. It seemed unbelievable to me that he would still be around. I have to say the detectives have never given up and were extremely dogged. They never gave up, even when I was ready to throw in the towel." At the time of Sarah's murder, Nicholas was a 27-year-old man who lived in Des Moines, around 7.8 miles from where Sarah was killed. Photographs of him at the time looked remarkably similar to the composite sketch. He already had a criminal conviction by this point, but since it happened in 1983, his DNA wasn't on file. That year, he had been arrested and charged with first-degree attempted rape. In that case, he had approached a teenage girl named Anne Crony, who was in her car.
On June 13th, 1983, at 10:30 in the morning, I was 21. I was leaning against the bumper of my car at a public park next to the Columbia River when Patrick Nicholas walked up to me and started a conversation.
He struck up a conversation with her before producing a knife and pressing it against her throat. He ordered Anne to remove her clothing before he stuffed her underwear in her mouth to prevent her from screaming for help. Nicholas then led Anne to a nearby river, but thinking quick, she launched herself into the river and swam for her life. Nicholas fled from the state, but he was quickly apprehended, charged, and convicted with attempted rape. He received a maximum sentence of 10 years. But he didn't even serve half of his sentence before he was released. The attempted rape of Anne was eerily similar to what had happened to Sarah. She later commented, "If the system had worked as it should have, he would have been in prison until 1993. The system failed me, it failed Sarah and countless others." In the years that followed, Nicholas was arrested several more times. He was arrested in King County for first-degree assault charges for child molestation, which was settled as assault in the fourth degree. during the search of Nicholas's home after he was arrested for Sarah's murder, detectives made an ominous discovery. Among the items found was a newspaper article dated 1994, recounting the details of Sarah's murder. They also stumbled upon a torn-out picture of a cheerleader, evidently clipped from a magazine. On the 29th of October 2019, Nicholas pleaded not guilty to the murder of Sarah. The murder trial began on the 17th of April 2023. During opening statements, prosecutor Celia Lee told the jury that the case was solved with advancements in DNA technology.
Sarah Yarbrough fought for her life that morning, where she was sexually assaulted, where she was strangled, and where she was killed.
She detailed how Nicholas came to be the prime suspect before telling the jury. The state is confident that at the conclusion of this case, you will hold that man, Patrick Leon Nicholas, accountable for what he did on that hillside, in the dirt, in the brush, at her school that morning, all those years ago, and that you will find him guilty. Defence attorney David Mondes, on the other hand, said that Nicholas didn't match the description of the killer provided by the eyewitnesses. He said that after thousands of tips and years of dead-end leads, detectives were desperate to solve the case.
And so police kept looking, but they had a really good idea of what the person they're looking for looked like. He would have acne scars on his cheek, and he'd have eyes like that. That's what he would look like. And so days turn to weeks, turns to months, turns to years, turns to decades. And as I've already told you, the King County Police, what ultimately became the King County Sheriffs, became desperate. And they're using these different tactics and nothing's coming to fruition.
The defense attorney also questioned the reliability of the DNA evidence in the case. The testimony promptly got underway, with various people testifying about the crime scene. Then the focus of the trial shifted towards the forensic evidence and how the evidence at the crime scene matched Nicholas. This included the semen, but also his DNA was discovered underneath Sarah's fingernails. Nicholas's DNA matched the DNA from the crime scene, and the odds that it would match a random individual was 1 in 120 quadrillion. Ultimately, the jury found Patrick Leon Nicholas guilty of the murder of Sarah Yarbrough. Nicholas returned to court on the 25th of May to learn his sentence. Sarah's family were allowed to address him for the very first time. Through tears, Lori said,
"Sarah's death left our family broken. She left a huge hole in our hearts. I ask that you sentence the defendant to the longest sentence possible."
She said that Sarah was the delight of her life, smart, creative, with a smile that lit up the room. She said, "She made those of us around her better. She was a person who built bridges and brought people together, but in her own quiet way." The family described how generations of girls learned far too early that there were men out there who wanted to hurt them. Nicholas had become Federal Way's boogeyman, a nightmare come real. But now, he was unmasked. Sarah's brother Andy, who had been 11 years old when his sister was killed, said to the court, "I recall the pain in my father's voice over the phone telling me that Sarah was dead. I recall the sounds of my parents crying through the walls at night as I lay in bed." Judge Josephine Wiggs then addressed the courtroom, stating, "It's so cruel that someone who was so young, so generous with her spirit and so concerned with the safety of others would be the victim of such predatory, depraved conduct." She added that she was disturbed by the fact that Nicholas was on parole at the time of the murder for an earlier attempted rape. The judge then sentenced Nicholas to 45 and a half years in prison. The advancement of DNA technology has revolutionized criminal investigations, providing detectives with a powerful tool to catch killers who once seemed beyond reach. For decades, Patrick Nicholas thought that he had committed the perfect crime, despite the amount of evidence he had left behind. But in the end, he was identified as Sarah Yarborough's killer, thanks to these advancements and a dogged determination by detectives who never gave up hope. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Rebecca. You can join us up on Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel your subscription at any time. Patreon really helps independent shows continue, and as a one-woman show, I really do appreciate the support. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you may be listening. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.